Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast in Budget Week. The government's big about turn to embrace the Gonski needs-based funding model for schools has set off a new political row, with the Catholic school sector in particular up in arms. Labor, whose advantage on the schools issue was undercut by the move, has strongly attacked the coalition's new policy, saying it would provide $22 billion less over a decade than the ALP had promised. Labor has also taken up the cause of the Catholics, who dispute the government's argument that they would be getting a fair share of the $18.6 billion that it is promising over the next 10 years. Today, we're joined by Andrew Giles, who is Shadow Assistant Minister for Schools and a convener of the left faction in the ALP. Andrew Giles, Labor is strongly arguing the case against the government's policy. Will it vote against it?
Well, at the moment, Michelle, it's unclear what we will have to vote against, but we will continue to stand up for equity in schools.
So how can it leave open voting against a fairly big slab of new money, even though it's not as much as Labor is promising?
Well, it's quite a bit less, over $6 billion over the forward estimates, and as you mentioned in your introduction, $22 billion. And I think everyone who's thought hard about schooling understands the difference this will make, and also the cost of delay. People in schools today will be waiting a very long time to see their schools reach the schooling resourcing standard. That's the real difference between these two propositions. A Labor proposal that will have got 95% of students there by 2019 towards a lesser outcome by 2027. That's a lifetime in terms of schooling and something that we are very concerned about and will be very firm in our opposition to. But as I say, it's not clear yet how we will have an opportunity to formally put that opposition.
Just conceptually, though, one can surely argue that the government's new policy is an improvement on steady as she goes, just a continuation, a rolling over of where things were going. So wouldn't it be logical for Labor to say, well, it's better than it was and we'll later promise more and support it on those grounds?
Well, I think that's the proposition that the Prime Minister and Minister Birmingham are advancing, but it's a pretty bizarre proposition. They talk about ending the school funding wars, but of course, Michelle, as you'd know, it's a war they started when they walked away from the previous unity ticket on Gonski funding. So calling a $22 billion cut a win because it's better than a $30 billion cut is a pretty odd proposition. It's one that we are struggling with.
On the other hand, Labor won't say at the moment whether it will promise $22 billion extra at the election. When will we know that?
Well, we're a long way from the election, Michelle. We've only just started our platform development cycle. But
could be next year.
It could be next year indeed, but we've only just started our platform cycle. And I guess what we can say in this is we made very hard decisions in the last parliament to fully fund Gonski to maintain that commitment. So I think Australians, and particularly Australians concerned with schooling, can see that we have a very, very strong track record in making hard decisions to secure Australians' future through financing education.
Just in straight political terms, the government's clearly moved onto some of Labor's grounds in this schools policy. To what extent do you think this is going to make it harder, assuming this package gets through, perhaps with the support of the Greens, to what extent is it going to make it harder to make this your issue at the election?
Well, I think Australians, when they look hard at this package, will see it's all about the politics of the day and not about Australians' future. And I think as we spend more time looking through the devil in the detail in this package and also its consequences, Australians will well understand that if you're concerned about education as a fundamental right, if you're concerned about the individual benefits of education, seeing every Australian child, no matter of their circumstances, having every opportunity to fill their potential, and also recognising that education is the key to maintaining Australia as a high wage economy, maintaining living standards, it's Labor Party that's the party for you. I'm glad you mentioned the Greens positioning because I'm really concerned about this. A party concerned about equity in education would be concerned to see Australian students reach the student schooling resource standard early, not kicking that can down the road by 8 years. So I'm very, very hopeful the Greens will look hard at this and look hard at themselves and change the position they seem to be suggesting they're moving towards.
Labor's sympathetic to the Catholics' opposition to parts of this deal. How do you think they're being treated unfairly? In what way are they being not given a fair deal?
Well, fundamentally, there are some really big questions of process here, Michelle. This is a really significant piece of public policy that impacts millions of Australians, and yet it seems that that body responsible for educating one in five Australians was given almost no notice of changes which fundamentally vary the terms upon which they provide schooling to hundreds of thousands of kids.
Well, if we put aside that question of consultation and say, yes, perhaps they should have been consulted ahead of time, although one can say, well, should every sector have been consulted ahead? But putting that aside, in substance, why are they being treated unfairly?
Well, the process and the substance are closely related, Michelle. We're in May now. Schools and school systems are well advanced in planning how they're going to provide for schooling next year. So I just make that point because the process isn't simply an abstract point. It goes to the decisions that schools are making. And what's different in the Catholic system from the independent sector is the practice of making systemic decisions. And that's something which has been fundamentally ignored by the minister and the government in the manner in which this proposal has been outlined. There's obviously also very significant issues going to the quantum of support going to the sector, which is raising very real concerns. And today's papers are full of anxiety and apprehension through the sector and through parents about the prospect of very significant fee rises going to reshape parental choice.
One objection of the Catholics is that the government is going to list what each school is notionally, in their case, eligible for. The money goes to the whole system and they can reallocate it as they wish. But parents will be able to look up and see what their school gets. The Catholic school authorities are objecting to that, but doesn't that seem reasonable enough?
Well, I'm not sure that it does, and certainly the manner in which this is being presented seems to be all about managing the politics of the issue rather than maintaining an effective relationship with a really important sector and respecting its capacity to make decisions about how it manages itself, recognising, of course, that these are Commonwealth funds and they should be accounted for.
You speak of managing the politics, but in a way it would have been easier to manage the politics by just giving them another special deal, wouldn't it?
Well, Michelle, I think the language of special deals is an unfortunate aspect of this conversation. As you would be probably much more aware than I, schools funding has been an intractable debate in Australian politics for longer than I have been alive. And the fact remains that what the National Plan for Schools Improvement was turning a large number of special deals, well more than 27, into a single agenda. Now, clearly, the only way you get to a single approach is by recognising that different schools and different schooling systems are at different levels of engagement. So different arrangements are necessarily required to get to a schooling resource standard, which is common. So I think that language of special deals is an unfortunate aspect of this debate.
The government's also announced that David Gonski, who did the original review into funding, or headed it, will undertake another review, this time into getting better schools' outcomes, better outcomes from students when we've been flatlining or falling behind internationally. Do you support that?
Well, I don't think anyone would object to doing more work on improving schooling outcomes in Australia, but there's actually a very large body of work, and as you recognise, obviously David Gonski was part of the panel that oversaw that. And most of, I think, the learnings about practice are actually clear. The challenge for a Commonwealth government is to recognise that it's by providing the resources that would enable good practice to be implemented in every school that will turn around educational outcomes. And that's a challenge that can't wait another 8 years, Michelle. It needs action now.
Do you think the only reason we're not doing better internationally on outcomes is money, or do you concede there are other problems in recruiting good teachers, in our whole learning culture and the inadequacies in that?
Look, there are really big questions to be explored here, and I'm not suggesting, and I don't think anyone is suggesting, it's all about money. But we do know when it comes to the questions of equity outcomes, for example, which is something that Australia seems to be doing worse and worse on, as well as the absolute findings that PISA and other international comparators are showing, that it's individual attention and it's providing appropriate attention to students based on their individual need. Now, that, of course, was the fundamental finding in the original Gonski review, and that sort of attention costs money.
Labor took as its own David Gonski after that review. How do you feel about his, not exactly going over to the other side, but nevertheless praising what this government is doing and becoming part of its school policy?
Look, I'm not placed to speak for the decisions that Mr. Gonski, or Dr. Gonski, I think I should say, makes. He was part of a really important bit of work that enabled the Gillard and Rudd governments to end what was a real funding war over the Commonwealth's involvement in schooling. So I think he deserves great credit for that. I think the challenge, though, is not to look to him as a human shield, as perhaps the Prime Minister is doing, but to do justice to the existing body of work that he has put before us, along with others like Carmen Lawrence, who has expressed some very significant concerns about the current decision as another panel member of the previous report.
Can I turn to your role in the left and the left's interest in the so-called Buffett rule, a mandated rate of taxation on high income earners? You've written on this and it's become something of a cause for the left, and yet Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen has made it clear that this wouldn't be embraced by a Labor government. Firstly, what do you see as the advantages of a Buffett-type rule?
I think the attention that's been drawn to the Buffett rule relates to two things running together. One is a recognition, which I think has been central to the success of Bill Shorten's leadership of Labor, which is that inequality in Australia is at a record post-depression high, and it's the fundamental challenge for Australian governments, both as a moral imperative in terms of our sense of the fair go, but also as an economic imperative in terms of our increasing understanding that excessive inequality is a brake on growth. But the other side to it is this understanding that right around the developed world, we are seeing reactionary forms of populism emerge, which go to people's confidence in government's capacity to deliver that sort of fair go. And I think why there's been so much interest in the Buffett rule is it ties together those two things, Michelle. One, a sense that we have a small group of people who are doing extraordinarily well out of present circumstances, and a sense of frustration that perhaps the storytelling of government has become so technocratic and complicated that many ordinary people feel that their involvement can't make a difference. And I think that's the importance of this as a concept, as a symbol of what can be done to turn around something that should be turned around.
Well, why is it so hard to get support for it? Within the ALP?
Well, I think it's important to recognise, as I say, that the symbolic importance of it rather than perhaps the Buffett rule as representing a particular prescription. And I should acknowledge, of course, the work that Chris Bowen in particular did in the last parliament in terms of his leadership on capital gains tax and negative gearing reform, another key attack on negative gearing that clearly also responds to people's concerns about how the political system works as well. I think there is an appetite in federal Labor to do more to reduce inequalities of wealth and inequalities of income as well. That's been central to our agenda, and I hope that I and others can continue to make a contribution to how we find the right policy instruments, obviously working with Chris.
And it came up at the last ALP National Conference, and I think it was to be reviewed after that. What's happened to that review?
Look, as someone who's not a member of the economic team, I can't comment on the details of that review. My concern again is to make sure that we keep a focus on attacking inequities and inequality, including having a hard look at how we look at our tax system. And that's really the point that the Fabian essay that I contributed to made, that if we're serious about tackling inequality, we need to think really hard about taxes. The essay starts by taking up that famous quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes about taxes being the price of civilization, but making the proposition that they're actually, from our perspective, much more than that, because how we tax things shapes how our society functions. And it's really that recognition that goes to the core, I think, of the difference between the Labor Party that Bill Shorten's been leading and the government's attitude to these questions, Michelle.
Just to come back specifically to the Buffett rule, will it be considered again at the next ALP conference?
Well, I note that as a matter of policy, Chris Bowen has said that it's not something that he'll be advocating at the next election.
So in that case, it probably won't be pushed at the conference?
Well, we're a long way off that conference. It will be held in July next year, Michelle. Delegates haven't been elected to the conference, so I'm just a bit reluctant to speak on behalf of people that I'm not placed to speak on before, but Chris has been quite clear in setting out his position on this.
Just about that conference in general, do you think that there'll be really vigorous policy debates, or will it be so close to an election that it'll be mainly about showcasing the leader, showcasing the opposition?
Look, I think the Labor Party's at its strongest when we do have vigorous policy debates. Michelle, as someone who's participated in a few and generally been on the losing side of them, I think it's having those debates that again goes back to connecting more people to a sense that politics matters. I really have no idea when the next election will be, but I'm sure that Federal Labor is more than capable of continuing to have respectful exchanges of ideas about those things that will deliver a fairer Australia.
And what would some of those debates be, do you think, in the economic field or asylum seekers?
I think the work that's being done about how Australia responds to changes in the world of work will be very central to how Labor, as a party and as a movement, deals with our policy agenda for the next few years. I think that will be absolutely critical as a debate that we've got to have within the party and in the community.
One of the issues that's starting to arise in that context is the idea of a guaranteed minimum income as employment becomes a more difficult issue, especially full-time employment with automation and so on. People are looking to that concept about income. What do you feel about that?
Look, I think it's a really interesting idea and it's one that should be worked through seriously. I guess as someone who's a proud member of the Australian Labor Party, I think that work's pretty important, Michelle, and I think we should be very shy about stepping away from our commitment to support full employment and to keep a clear focus on providing jobs and secure jobs. I think the real value of UBI is perhaps to test propositions about how we maintain the foundations of a good society. And I think that's an issue that's really worth exploring, but through a prism that still prioritises work. I know that some writers, Paul Mason and the like, seem to think that we are moving towards a post-work world. And I guess whenever I read this, I think that that's, of course, what John Maynard Keynes prophesied in the 1930s. And he hasn't proved to be right, has he?
And just finally, I think back about the left in previous years, in previous decades. The current left in the ALP does seem a very docile beast compared to its predecessors. Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure about that characterisation. In fact, I guess I'd reject the term docile, Michelle. I think the great challenge for anyone in the Labor Party is recognising that we are a broad-based movement. I think we should be a big tent party, a party that has room, if we think about the election that's just taken place in France, for both a Macron and a Mélenchon type figure. And I think the challenge for those of us on the more radical wing is to get the balance right between discipline and dissent. And
it used to be more towards dissent, and now it's more towards discipline.
Well, I think most people recognise that effective political parties are disciplined ones that have good conversations, serious conversations in-house, and in the Labor Party, unlike our rivals in the Greens, we play out those conversations in public at our conferences. But I think our challenge on the left is to make sure we get that balance right. On individual issues, I'm sure we'll always disappoint people. But as someone who is a proud member of the left and a prouder member of the Labor Party, I see my role as making a contribution to the work of Labor governments, not to conversations around dinner party conversations.
Thank you, Andrew Giles, for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Balage. We'll be back with another interview later in the week.